Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. Today, I'm very happy to be joined by my good friend and fellow colleague, Pat McDonald, also of HollywoodChicago.com. And, we talk about many filmmakers. We talk about many people that interest us. And one person that just routinely comes up is Mr. Woody Allen. And it's easy to have his voice come up again and again in our discussions because he seems to make a film every 2 seconds. It seems like every time we enter a screening room, if it's not a film by Allen, it's one next week.
In our lifetime, in our generation, Matt, wouldn't you say he's our most prolific filmmaker?
Absolutely. Yes. And not just ours, of like a couple generations, a few generations, at least in terms of American film.
Yes.
You know, I mean, we can look back at John Ford, who's pumping out 10 masterpieces every year. But it is very rare to see someone who for filmmaking for him is like a compulsion. It really is like that. This is his, you know, way to sort of preserve his sanity.
It's just his work. It's his life.
Exactly.
It's intertwined.
Yes. And when he finishes a movie, that's it. He never wants to watch it again.
Right.
It's just kind of like, okay, it's done, and it hasn't satisfied my lofty expectations. I'm just going to let it go out to the public and work on the next one, hope that one's better.
And what's interesting about that is he gives us the gift of these films, and he moves along. So his evolution through it is much different than our evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there have been books and magazine articles and PBS specials, and he could care less because his evolution through it, as you said, is just making the film and being part of that creative process.
Yes.
That just occurred to me.
Yeah. Well, basically, on this show, what we want to rank, and we're going to discuss, we have different choices for this, is the top five worst, and I don't want to say worst,
not
Woody Allen
worst
movies,
not worst,
because I feel like he's a filmmaker where even the worst films have some semblance of worth. And
there
some,
always
some,
will be a line in
yeah,
it.
It's a
there
great
always
Woody line.
Will be a moment.
Yes, that you can savor. But I feel like Allen is his own like worst critic. I mean, because he'll look at something like Manhattan or Hannah and Her Sisters, and he'll see just all the shortcomings that he can see. He'll see the film that he wanted to make, and he can't really see it for what it is.
Yeah.
So I don't think he can even judge really the worth of what his work really
amounts to. Yes, yes. And this is very subjective because, you know, in the depth and breadth of his career, it's been, you know, even when there's a slight slump, suddenly there'll be a Match Point or suddenly there'll be a Midnight in Paris. And that's one of the most satisfying elements of it. If you follow a filmmaker's career and you think, oh, he's done, blah, blah, you know. Like Albert Brooks is a perfect example of someone who left at the table at some point and never came back. But Allen is willing to come back, try and try and try and try again and let it out there. And, you know, again, Match Point and Midnight in Paris for me of the late period Allens are the best. And I don't know if you agree or disagree with that.
Oh, no. I mean, we could definitely talk about the best, too. I mean, there's many different titles we can go over. But I feel like, you know, there's a value in criticism of sort of, and I feel like, you know, the people that you love and the films that you love, it's just as important to say those as it is the films that you don't, that you have issues with. Because I think the critics that I really value are the ones that actually care about the art form and aren't just so cynical and jaded that it's just become just like a thing to kind of disassemble and just sort of, it's like when I really care about someone like Woody Allen, it's like a negative review is just as much of a loving piece of writing as a good review.
Absolutely. So, no, that's a perfect point on this. And I think even in all, I'm looking at this list and I don't think I ever had the opportunity of any of these films that I would call his lesser Woody Allen films to write a full review, except maybe on my blog way back when. So it'll be just interesting to discuss it from these contexts. And it will be interesting to see if any of the films on our lists are actually ones that we would put in the upper echelon.
Exactly.
So, I don't think it's going to happen, but...
And that's true of my first. So I'll go
right.
to my first.
Well, we're going to number five first.
Well, this is our number five.
Fifth, yes, okay.
The five. And this is Shadows and Fog from 1991, which to me is really the first, like, Allen turkey for me.
Interesting.
Because it's a film that is just so so sour. Like the humor is so mean and so sour, and it's basically like his take on noir films.
Yes,
and you have some amazing cinematography. The best thing in it is the cinematography. It's so gorgeous in the shadows. But I just feel like it's such a mean, bitter, little nasty little movie that it just kind of leaves you feeling unclean. And that's a lot of people said that about Stardust Memories, but I feel like there's still such
Stardust
beauty
Memories
in that
is one
film
of my favorites.
Such honesty. But this is the one where I was kind of like, Alan was in a bad mood.
That's
when he
a good
this.
Choice. And but I put that in the medium level between the good and the bad. There's a mystery to that film that I can't fathom. We were talking a little about this in association with Hitchcock, in the sense that we see the creator's personality or his mm-hmm. psyche come through, and we certainly see that as a thread through Alan's career, and certainly that sourness that was in Shadow and Fog.
It's something that I don't remember seeing in earlier stuff. Like, it's really, I mean there's some stuff that sounds like a gag, that sounds like a gag line, and
right.
it's not funny.
Right.
I mean, there's
right.
some really mean stuff, but it's good enough that it leaves that impact on you. But it's not a movie I want to see again. Like,
okay.
usually with Alan, I want to keep seeing the stuff.
Right.
Shadows and Fog was like, okay, go away.
All right. My number five, sir, is Mighty Aphrodite.
Mm.
And you know where that film fails, I think it was sort of an incomplete thesis. The genius of it, I think, is the Greek chorus in the background. But I just felt that I was cold toward that movie. It was very cold and felt to me very incomplete. What's your take
on
that?
Well, I remember laughing a lot. You know, when I saw it, I thought Mira Sorvino was a lot of fun, as kind of the dumb, you know, bubble-headed.
Got the Oscar.
And that's one of Alan's favorite type of women, is kind of the bubble-headed, very sexually liberated, you know, blonde female.
We'll get to that later.
We'll get to that later. So it was entertaining enough, but it's true that that's not one that I've sought out to see again. And it was very much, it felt like a lot of artificial happiness. Like, there's even, you know,
yes.
the song choice at the end, when
yes.
you're smiling, the whole world's smiling
yeah.
with you. And it was Alan's way of recovering after the whole Mia Farrow scandal and everything. So it was kind of like his way of saying we can get on with our lives, but it kind of felt a bit hollow.
Was everybody says I love you after my Aphrodite? Was that his first foray into some sort of musical realm?
I think
realm?
The musical came after.
Yes.
So this was the prelude.
Right.
The
so this was the warm-up to Everybody Says I Love You, which has its flaws too, but much better movie. So let's go to number four.
Okay.
Your number four?
My number four, it shares a similarity with Shadows and Fog in that it's also in black and white and also has a huge amount of great actors who are completely wasted for the most part.
All
and
right.
that's my issue
right.
with these two
all
films. Because right. in Shadows and Fog, can I just say the people in that?
Right.
John Malkovich, Madonna, Lily Tomlin,
right.
Jodie Foster, Kathy
My
Bates,
God.
John Cusack, John C. Reilly, Fred Gwynne, William H. Macy, all of these people just wasted. All of them ice on the screen. Same thing happens in Celebrity from 1998,
oh,
which came a few years
boy.
After. And this was Kenneth Branagh doing like a kind of Alan shtick, is kind of, you know,
yes.
I think he was a journalist,
yes.
kind of a loathsome
yes,
guy
I
that was
yeah.
palling around with celebrities. It had just felt very, and again, a film that just felt very, just sort of acidic in its humor, and not in a good way. It just gave you indigestion.
I will also say about Celebrity that it was Alan's foray into trying to make a definition for his own fame through a Leonardo DiCaprio character who was many, many years younger.
Mm-hmm.
So
and DiCaprio is the best thing in it.
Yes.
As this guy who's very obsessed with his ego and
right.
pushing it around.
Right. And the thing is about, I think it was a 1960s view of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because his hottest period as a young man was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was sort of a memoir of that time. And so it felt kind of out of place. But again, I put that in the middle. And it did have that extraordinary scene with the skywriting. I
Oh,
really,
was that the last
that
one?
That really yeah, touched
the,
me in
the
that
surrender
movie.
Dorothy moment.
Right. Was it Help Me or Help Us? Or,
something like Help
yes,
Me.
Yes,
yes. Like
it's been
so
a long time
it was
I've
interesting. I know he always, yeah, I think everyone keeps saying Bergman was a big influence. I think that he's doing a lot of Fellini stuff too, you know, with the big colorful ensemble.
Well, this as a side note, like Branagh is definitely doing his Alan in it. And of course, we saw Will Ferrell and Melinda mm-hmm. attempting to do an Alan. Anybody else you can really think of who? Oh, Cusack was in Bullets
Over
Broadway,
yeah.
but he wasn't doing an imitation. So much, but
yeah, this one just it just felt there's not a lot of memorable stuff in it. So
now this one's gonna may blow you away. My
okay.
number four,
let's see.
Vicky Cristina Barcelona,
because a lot of people said that was again another return to form, a little back
yes,
in the slump. Sort
yes,
of thing.
And I just
2008
again that left me cold. And Penelope Cruz getting the Oscar for that performance, no way, no way. I very underwritten. you know, the highlight of the wasn't who did Johansson play with, Vicky or Christina?
I can't remember either.
But the other actress was
Rebecca
much better.
Hall. Let's say that name again.
Rebecca Hall. Thank you, Rebecca Hall.
And she did give the best performance in that film.
I really enjoyed
the film a lot. I don't think it's great, Alan, but I'd put it in the middle because it's a film.
This is very interesting.
That is about like the American idea of fidelity and then the European and kind of mixing them them together. And I enjoyed enough of it and sort of Alan's dissection, and I felt, and especially Hall is the key to that film's success for me. She's the one that you can sort of.
But because she's one of the least elements of it, and sort of disappears by the end, where we're left with the
with Cruz and Bardem sort of camping it up. So yeah, it's interesting. See, I don't think there's anything okay, but we'll see. You have to listen to the end of this podcast because the last few that I have, I'm very.
All right, at least
like the last couple, I'll say.
All right. Well, I have anger for my number three, which is Small Time Crooks.
Mm.
That was a attempt for him to return to form to his early funnier pictures, as he says, in Stardust Memories. And I just, that was miscast. Wasn't Rappaport in that? I did not like him.
I think Tracy Ullman was his wife in that.
Oh, really?
There was a lot of interesting.
It was almost like a TV movie that he was doing, but he got the.
It was like Don't Drink the Water, which was a TV movie that actually has some good moments
especially from the actress. That's an old play of him.
Yes, exactly. I think that one's a better one. Actually, number three, I have to go back to my number three really quick. I forgot to say that.
No, I was just switching it up.
Oh, totally. Oh, no. That's good.
Go ahead.
But anything else from 2002?
Oh, I have a soft spot for anything else.
Well, see, I want to understand the soft spot. I want you to describe. Because I think Quentin Tarantino, when he was like listing his favorite films of the decade, I think anything else was in that list.
Wow.
And I was like, what is it? Because I just feel like everything felt like such a forced teen version of Annie Hall. And I hate to say it, but the main reason why it felt forced to me was Christina Ricci's performance.
Okay.
And Ricci's someone who I've loved as a teenager, you know, all the Wednesday Addams performances. It seems like she's really struggled to keep that naturalism in her performance. She's just gotten blander as she's gotten older. And I hate to say that about someone, but I just felt
interesting.
That, you know, with some exceptions, like Monster especially, with Charlize Theron, she's great in that. But.
Well, the thing, here's the deal with that one. I saw it in the theater and didn't like it immediately, as you just said. Mm-hmm. And then as it went on cable and everything, for some reason, it was one of those in the mix movies on the HBO channels. And I kept going back to it for some reason, and it grew on me.
And what was it about it?
The mentor-student relationship between
Alan
and
Jason Biggs.
Yes.
And they're pushing Jason Biggs as the star. They kept trying to hide the fact that Alan was even
in
the ads because Biggs was the big American Pie star.
But it seemed like almost the Alan character didn't exist, that it was a figment of his imagination because he was going through a life crisis at the moment. And so he used...
So it was like an older version, or like a would-be older version of himself?
Right, like somebody trying to give him advice from his own experience. So maybe I'm reading into it a bit, but I did like it.
Well, now you make me want to see it again. this is really just a cloaked way of saying see all of Alan's movies.
It's definitely in the middle. It goes down to the middle.
Yes, yes.
All right, you're number two, sir.
Okay, my number two is a film I never want to see again. It's called Scoop from 2006. And if you realize, I've gone 91, 98, 2000. I think these films get progressively worse as time goes on. I don't want to say Alan's getting worse, but the films themselves are getting worse.
You just named my number one, sir.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so let's have a longer discussion.
Yes, we will.
This film, we can get to it when you just say it's your
number one. No. Let's start now. Go ahead.
This film doesn't have a single line that I remember with pleasure. Because there's a lot of screwball banter between Woody Allen and Scarlett Johansson in this film. And Johansson has she's a multifaceted actress, many skills. She's not a good screwball comedian. She cannot rattle off those lines in a way that they just land with like the thud of an anvil, basically.
Well, I'll tell you, it's
partly her and partly just the dry staleness of the writing.
Yes, and definitely stale writing. But the fact that he wants to create a comedienne, and I use the ENNE out of Scarlett Johansson, is one of the most failed projects in movie history. Mm. She has no comic timing. And, well, of course, the script didn't help her. And as you recall, it's all over the place. They go, like, down to Hades, mm-hmm. you know.
It's a film that's very breathless, but they just keep moving because there's no gags wherever they can go. So they just become increasingly desperate. The speed of the film gets desperate, and then it finally ends. And
it's
like,
almost Dante's Nine Circles.
Yes.
We just keep going deeper and deeper. And we get nowhere.
It's like running a marathon and burning no calories. It's like, what was the point? What was the point of this?
Very good, sir. Yeah, so that was definitely, that's my least favorite Woody Allen mm-hmm. film. And mm-hmm. I kind of think it'll disappear over the years.
Yeah.
And then but will be rediscovered like in, you know, 2080 and become some sort of cult thing. You know, because that's how weird and disconnected it is from all his other works.
So. And it was around that point where I was like, maybe Allen will just never do another funny movie. Maybe he's just more interested in more serious subject matter.
It seemed like,
Match Point came right before that, and that was such a success. Right. I really enjoy that film a lot. I don't know if it's great, Allen, but it's great, at least in the later period of Allen's work. And it is kind of a riff on the serious half of Crimes and Misdemeanors, which is one of his masterpieces, in my opinion.
Well, that was the big complaint about the movie. It was sort of a quasi-remake of...
Exactly.
Crimes and Misdemeanors, but
I thought there was a point for that. I thought there was a reason for that to be made in its younger characters and its more modern time, and it just following that through its trajectory without the comic stuff, which was a reason why Allen has trouble looking back at Crimes and Misdemeanors. He wishes the comic stuff was pulled out and he could just focus on the drama. So that's why he probably.
I have a quick anecdote about that film.
Yeah, yeah.
The actor who played the brother, Matthew Good. Thank you,
mm-hmm.
Matthew Good. So I interviewed him about another film. I can't remember which one it was. It was a long time ago, like 3 or 4 years ago. So I had to ask him about Match Point. And he said, the great thing about working with Woody Allen is he says, whatever you feel comfortable with the character doing, just do. So he said, I just smoke and drank through the entire movie.
That's about it.
My character smokes and drinks. Oh, that's great. Do it.
That's great.
I love that.
And I have to admit, the film picks up halfway through. It gets very, very compelling. I do think the first half drags a bit, and there is a lot of smoking and drinking. You can almost say that for the whole first half of the movie is just a smoke drink effect.
Well, I like the fact that he uses the theme of luck. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I don't want to spoil the movie, but, you know, there's a theme of, I don't care if he's, you know, if he's born rich, I just hope he's born lucky, mm-hmm. you know. And I think people don't understand that about their own life. That the toss of the coin and the way it flips off the banister mm-hmm. suddenly affects everything, the butterfly effect or whatever you want to call it. But just the theme of luck, I like.
And it's Allen's argument that just keeps coming in every single thing, keeps coming with everything, every single film, is that a life is chaos. Basically, where it's mm-hmm. just it's randomness and chaos, and there's always kind of a darkness to the humor. You're laughing, but it's like you're laughing into a void, and it's interesting. But
and that void is called Scoop.
And that void is called Scoop, exactly. But that's why I think before we go to our number one picks, I have to see
for
your number
me, it will
two
be
as well.
Two, yeah.
Midnight in Paris. Why I think that was such a huge hit was because. The film is essentially saying, okay, life is chaos, but deal with it. It was sort mm-hmm. of like the Kathy Bates character and mm-hmm. that says that to mm-hmm. the hero. It's like, what's the point of making a work of art that says life is pointless? Find a point. Well, and there was a certain optimism to that film that it didn't feel forced. It felt genuine, which was very odd.
Well, also, too, Allen is a man who's always relied on the nostalgia of his own soul. Mm-hmm. You know, likes the old Louis Armstrong jazz and plays, and you know, he's a man out of time, maybe born a little too late. And for him to say baldly in Midnight in Paris that looking backwards is a ridiculous thing to do, live the life that you have because that's all you have, was amazing. It was either a breakthrough on a psychiatrist's couch, run out of ideas, and boy, I've never explored this one, huh?
Yeah,
so
no,
won't
I
people
agree.
Be surprised?
So. I totally agree.
So,
I totally agree.
Now, this number two is one of the reasons, and I'm glad we didn't discuss these before because it's much more interesting, mm-hmm. but this is one that you hadn't seen, and it's Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
And I'll say that's the only, I've even seen Don't Drink the Water, which is amazing. I mean, I even saw like the film that he dubbed over, the Tiger Lily. So.
I've seen that. Did you see You'll Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger?
Mm-hmm, I saw that, too.
I didn't see that. I haven't seen September.
Oh, okay.
I haven't seen... I think that's it. I haven't seen.
But Jay, tell me why, because they're basically marking in time. A lot of critics said this was the film where we're starting to feel like he's run out of ideas.
Yes,
running out of steam.
And he himself plays a totally inappropriate role for his age and bearing. And I'm not saying I don't blame him from getting away from the typical Woody Allen character. I mean, you know, we love it, but of course, if you're only playing it and that's all you're doing.
And you should stop when you're done feeling it, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I don't blame him for wanting to do a film noir, you know, a takeoff on 1940s detective stories. But he just didn't have what it took in that movie to give it a, you know, any kind of flavor. It was flavorless. Mm-hmm. It laid there
and
like
The more I'm thinking that I may have actually seen it, but that's why it's such a bad movie is that you can't for the life of you remember
a thing about
thing about it. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And we're talking about Helen Hunt off the program, and boy, this is where she starts to also, you know, disconnect from whatever potential that we thought she had before.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that she's recently proven
that
in the sessions.
Recently proven
big
in the sessions
time,
that
big
she,
time.
She's
you know.
A player. So
yeah.
What was your final one on that list?
My
there?
Final one
your
on
number
the list.
One. This
and
will
I'm
be interesting.
So sad to say it because it was one of my most anticipated
oh,
movies
boy.
The last few years.
Oh my.
Is Whatever Works from 2009. This is the only Allen film.
Oh my gosh.
The only Allen film that I consider an embarrassment. I think I was embarrassed sitting there because this film was made at the height of Larry David's powers on Curb Your Enthusiasm,
right.
Which was just one of the funniest. I don't even know if it's even going to get another season, but for its run, it was one of the funniest sitcoms in modern times. And just this the most misanthropic character without any of the Woody Allen innocence, just a total misanthrope, and yet you just can't take your eyes off of him as he just digs a deeper and deeper hole for himself. It's just so funny. And I was like, this is perfect. Pairing him with Woody Allen, a Woody Allen script, this is going to be magic. I was in a theater that was sold out. People were just waiting to see this thing. We were so excited. Not a single laugh. Not a single laugh. And what was the problem was, it was like Allen trying to go back to his roots. We're going back to New York. We're going back to a story about a guy and a younger girl and a neurotic girl played by Evan Rachel Wood. And there's not a single bit of me that wanted them to get together. It just felt so artificially contrived, that relationship.
I keep saying, wow.
I know. And then by the end of the film, and I don't know if there was something wrong with the projector, but by the end of the film, there is a shot in that film that is out of focus. There's a shot in that film that is actually out of focus towards the end, and it just made me think of Robin Williams as the actor who's out of focus and Deconstructing Harry. It's like Allen is sort of has now become the man out of focus.
Well, I have a very, again, I'll put that in my middle block.
Okay, wow.
Only because, I will tell you, it seems like two movies to me. The first half is a train wreck. I agree. For one thing, using Larry David as a doppelganger for Woody Allen seems redundant, but totally didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And then to pair him off with Evan Rachel Wood as some sort of runaway, what was that?
Yeah.
It was.
She felt like the most artificial. And
it was
I think
thud.
Allen,
no chemistry whatsoever.
No.
But for some reason, it picks up again.
Mm.
To me, and the whole suicide thing was very interesting too. And I don't know, when he did the final walkthrough, the Allen walkthrough where you're sort of narrating what's going on, somehow I attached myself to that film.
Mm-hmm.
And no, you're right. It's definitely not even close to being watchable.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason,
I think there's one laugh in the movie for me.
Okay.
When, isn't Ed Begley Jr. in there?
Yes.
And
yes.
Doesn't he realize he's gay or some sort of thing like that? There was like one line at like the gay or like at a bar or something that I remember laughing at. But that was just another flaw of the film for me. I just do not believe in this transition. There's so many things, all these leaps I had to keep making that just became so just out of left field that it just fell apart. And I was really sad. I was like, oh no, Allen's finally lost it. But every time I say Allen's finally lost
it, he
surprises me again
yes.
and again and again. And that's why he's still one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. And he'll always be one
very
of my
favorite good.
Filmmakers
how are we doing
time.
Here? Just to talk a little about To Rome with Love.
Oh, sure.
Highly anticipated.
This is the one that came out this year.
Yes. Highly anticipated after, obviously, Midnight in Paris. And yet, again, here's what he'll do. You think he's going in one direction, and he just takes a turn and goes completely somewhere else or anything else. But
sure.
But in here, it was another example, episodic, a tribute to his old Fellini-esque favorites, where it was just episodes in a single town. And, you know, it just, some of it worked, some of it didn't. It had Penelope Cruz, and who I hope with Scarlett Johansson will never work with him again.
Well, and I have to say, for To Rome with Love, and it is a big mixed bag, it's hit or miss, and it's definitely not one of my favorites, but there are enough laughs in there where I would say it's worth a rental. Like, if you see it, it's definitely worth a rental. And this is the first time I've found Woody Allen himself, the actor, funny on screen since Hollywood Ending.
Wow.
This is the first time. I thought there were a lot of scenes with him that was
Hollywood Ending was my number
funny.
Six.
Oh, really? That's right.
I crossed out only because, again, for multiple viewings, it holds up. A blind director. It's funnier and funnier as it goes on.
It is.
But the first time I saw it, I just thought it was just
And it runs out of steam in the last third. And there's a lot of bad stuff. But it was a movie. This was actually the first Woody Allen movie I ever saw. Actually, it was Hollywood Ending, and I saw it in the theater. And there's a scene. This is the last thing I'll say before we go. It's out of focus, and I think like two women are talking in the foreground, and Allen is directing someone, and he's like on the second floor of a set, and he just turns around and falls. And it was just the timing of the pratfall. My friend was trying not to laugh for the next three scenes. It was one of those laughs that was so good.
Yes.
It just kept going and kept going. So, you know.
Well, I'll say the first one I saw on screen was Annie Hall. Mm-hmm. Because as a young film fan in the 1970s, I wasn't really exposed to him. He didn't come to Michigan City. And when I got to college, I saw Annie Hall. The same year it came out, but I saw it in the retrospect at college, and I was like, I got to see everything this guy does.
Absolutely.
And I did.
That's everyone's lightning rod moment. You see that opening monologue in Annie Hall, and you're hooked, and I'm hooked for life.
Very good.
Thank you so much, Pat, for your time. It was
very
a pleasure
good,
talking. And for all of Pat and my recent reviews and interviews, check out HollywoodChicago.com. And for my indie coverage, check out indie-outlook.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.